Pull up a chair and get comfortable because we're about to kick off a conversation with Jared Siegel, the mastermind behind Attitude. This chat isn't just any talk. It's a deep dive into the heart of digital advertising, where we uncover the secrets of keeping publishers safe in a world that never stops evolving. Jared's at the forefront, steering Attitude through the wilds of MFA sites and leading the charge in the first-party data revolution. Let's get started. And no more than you did yesterday.
Welcome to the AdAttach Show, where marketing, media, and ad tech merge. Stay tuned as your host, Pesach Latin, navigates you through the evolving landscape of marketing trends and advertising innovations.
Welcome to the AdAttach Show, where we explore media, marketing, and ad tech. I'm Pesach Latin. Today we're exploring with Jared Siegel on how he's revolutionizing advertising operations and transforming challenges into opportunities for innovation and growth in the ad tech space. Hey, Jared, first of all, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on again. You are not in a hotel room this time, I see. You were in your office.
Way back home in my office, yeah.
Where's that?
Westchester, New York. A rare day for me to be home.
Okay, very nice. We're going to talk a little bit about ad operations and made for advertising sites, I guess since everyone's talking about MFA sites. It's been in the news because approximately 11% of global open programmatic goes to MFA sites, yet MFA sites seem to have 20% higher ITV rates than non-MFA sites. So I guess the question is, why do we have MFA sites? How is Attitude staying ahead of the curve without getting caught in the crossfire?
Yeah, so we're hitting on some of the same topics we spoke about at the roundtable a few weeks ago. I think the first thing that's important to note is Attitude is very focused on putting the publishers first. We're way more focused on protecting our clients and ourselves than throwing the hunt against the best publishers in the space. I think I was kind of trying to go against the grain on the last roundtable where I said, hey, a lot of these sites that are being labeled as MFA are being improperly labeled. In fact, a lot of these sites are actually investing way more into their content. They actually have better user experiences. They have better user engagement levels, better time on site, or bounce rate, all that kind of stuff. And so I think, to answer your question, well, we're not going to work with companies that have falls in traffic, right? We're not going to work with companies that drive traffic through IDT or POP methodologies and things like that. But we don't stray away from publishers that drive a lot of their traffic from social. Probably not a surprise, but pretty much all the top comms for publishers drive a tremendous amount of their traffic for social.
Right.
And so I think there needs to be still a little bit of a rejigging of, like, consider MFA. Is it a site that just has a lot of ads? Is it a site that has invalid traffic? Is it a site that is just ads and no content at all? Theoretically, every website is MFA, right? Every website exists to serve ads. That's how they keep their lights on. So while we don't work with fraudulent companies, I am going to stand up a lot on behalf of our publishers that MFA labels are pretty incorrect, right?
So what do you think about Jounce Media's definition of MFA sites?
It's flawed.
Okay.
I've seen at times, I've joined some of their webinars in the past where they've gone through some publishers that they consider really premium.
Right.
And having been in the space for over a decade, I know for a fact a lot of those publishers drive the large majority of their traffic for paid, through paid means and have very aggressive layouts. Things like slideshows, right? Whereas a lot of publishers that are being flagged as MFA are small businesses that don't even do any acquisition of traffic until React. So
right.
I think there's sort of the automated methodologies that they're putting into place, while they're well intentioned, are not functioning the way that I think they should. And there's also a little bit of bias of, like, oh, they're a big company. No way they're MFA, right? They're a small company, must be MFA. That's, in most cases, the exact opposite of what's true.
I think it's important to note that 70% of MFA sites of ad spend is actually going to websites with a private domain, so you can't find out who the real owner is. What do you think the percentage of sites that are legit is then? I mean, obviously 30%.
Meaning, what percent of publishers that are legitimate media?
I have a better percent. So you're calling it a witch hunt, I noticed. So what percentage of publishers are being mislabeled, do you think?
I think a lot of them.
A lot.
I think a lot of the publishers that are being labeled as MFA are not, and I think a lot of the publishers that are not being labeled as MFA are very much MFA. The major companies out there, I spoke about this a little bit last time, where their entire business is just to drive traffic to pages that are 100% ads. So literally no content. It's just search ads. Probably think of a few of them, right? Somehow those are not MFA because they're not so...
Oh, yeah. I just put one on Twitter where it was an ad for an Audi car that does not actually exist. And I clicked on it and it sent me through... like a click stream of where the ads were right in my face,
yes.
And there's no choice but to click on the next ad to get the information. But and obviously, then I get to the Audi site, and that car doesn't exist. Right. And I'm pretty sure Audi didn't want
to. That's not MFA. According to our current guidelines, that's not considered MFA. There's no display ads on that page. Can't be MFA, right? To me,
but I doubt Audi wanted the.
No way, right? No way. I mean, I guess theoretically, if you have 7 clicks, maybe it's really qualified. But at the same time, that company, that website, surely exists to show ads. Like, literally, there's not putting any effort into content. Whereas a site that is slightly aggressive on advertising, but has really long-form content, there's not a lot of money right in that content, right? That's not MFA. The other stuff is MFA.
If you had a crystal ball, where do you see the saga of MFA sites heading?
Okay, so I think it's like the second or third time that we've kind of gone down this path. It's definitely getting a lot more steam now than it has in the past.
What was the first time? Flogs? Or you mean MFA specifically?
Go way back to like 2014, 2015 when the pop-up of slideshow websites came about, right? Like top 20 celebrities you didn't know. Or
BuzzFeed.
Like, yeah. That's it.
Which as of today may not even be around anymore.
Well, 100% of their content apparently is AI-generated, right?
Right.
Facebook banned that. Right? And they said, no, this is no good for the internet. No one wants to read it. And of course, their revenue fell. They were making way less from advertising. 2 years later, like, yeah, we're good with it. Bring it back. It's fine. Everyone like reads it anyway. Right? And I think we're kind of going to end up leaning towards that same scenario here again, where, you know, we have some DSPs come out and say, you know what, I'm going to look at this list, of MFA owned publishers. I'm blocking it. And now we have a major DSP dual verify coming out and they just say, actually, it's not quite that simple. Because a lot of these sites on these lists actually perform extremely well. Right?
Right.
They have great conversion rates and things like that. Right? And like, we're not gonna buy by this list. We're gonna create our own tiering system. And I think it's gonna start leading to that shift that people say, maybe social traffic is not bad. Right? They leave driving traffic to Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and all these other platforms. It's not too bad because these people are really engaged. Right? So I imagine we're going to go through the circle. We're going to kind of move on to the next thing, cookie apocalypse or whatever. That's going to become more important to them. And then 3 or 4 years from now, someone's going to bring it up again. We're going to go through this whole process again. And it's going to be a nice cycle.
And you think that part of is the lack of new sources? So we're trying to make ones up?
So is it traffic?
Yeah, I mean,
Google is certainly taking away a lot of traffic organically for publishers beyond like making updates to their algorithms, which can impact SEO-driven publishers. They're also just currently providing information themselves or scanning websites and just showing the results of the website to land instant results, right? So like, I think searching Google, the amount of times I actually click to another website is very slow, right? And so publishers don't really have a choice but to try to push more traffic through either organic social means or even paid means on these platforms. You know, there's some platforms that are still not legitimate, not good quality traffic, but you look at a major platform like Facebook, like it's going up and going up, and they're making way more money off of ads. Because advertisers think it's good quality traffic.
Moving on, in the era of privacy is king, and third-party cookies are crumbling faster than cookies at a toddler's hand. First-party data has become the new gold rush. As we venture into this cookieless frontier, how are you striking gold with first-party data without striking out on privacy?
Yeah, like we're in a similar position to most companies where we don't know what's coming.
Right.
In 6 months from now, I don't think Google even knows what's coming. Right, they're kind of changing their minds or rethinking it every day. What I always say is the money's not going away. Right, it's not like Google as a major advertiser who probably makes trillions of dollars, if not at least hundreds of billions of dollars off of this right a year, is just going to say, we're going to take a 30% cut, or we're going to take a 40% cut. That'd be a really bad business decision. So what I think is advertiser spend is going to start moving to other platforms, not other platforms, but something, maybe iOS performance is going to start popping, right? And I'm like, wait a second, iOS devices, no cookies and boosts and errors, they actually perform better than the Android, right? If you talk to advertisers right now who do things around contextual targeting or performance marketing, most of them will tell you iOS is it's pretty interesting. So I do think there's going to be some changes there.
Why is it more? Why is it better?
Typically more affluent users, more
early adopters, to
things like that. But anyways, to our approach to this, we're lucky in that we have a huge attitude ecosystem, right? We have tons of publishers that work within us. So we can basically say, hey, we're going to create our own user ID methodology, create our own platform for all the domains that are leveraging our technology and help advertisers identify those users across their own platform. Sure, we could adopt all the other third-party techs out there, but we can create some unique first-party within our own.
So you've created your own tech stack. Do I get that right? So some people say it's like building a spaceship. What gadgets and gizmos have you packed to ensure that your mission is successful on a daily basis?
Sure. So I think the most important thing to note is that everything that we do is built in-house. We don't white label anything or leverage anyone else's tech. And what that means is we have to be really on top of everything we're doing, right? We have to be really confident in work that we're doing. We have to be really confident in the results of and the output of any code release that we're doing, anything like that. For us, it's just constantly innovating and testing new ideas. I think what publishers that work with us will always comment on is how fast we move. We probably push close to 3,000 to 4,000 commits a week as a company. And all of those are getting pushed live, right? We are moving as fast as humanly possible, testing every idea possible that we can come up with to try to not just ensure rigidity and stability of our code, but obviously improve performance of our publishers.
Speaking of regulation, how do you keep attitude on the right side of privacy's laws but also be creative?
Yeah. So we take a really a hard stance here. We check for CNP. To exist on the site. And if it does that, we don't even allow ads to have calls to happen. We cancel Google, we cancel preview, we cancel ads, we just cancel the entire request. For us, it's we'd rather not risk anything there, right? Whether it's us tracking data or our publishers allowing advertisers to track data. If we are unsure if they are kind of a law, we don't let them break the law. But we do have what I would consider our internal resident CMP. The expert who spends a lot of time training our clients, going for whatever CMP platform they work in, making sure all the settings are correct. We obviously have our own recommendations that we offer to our clients. And we've spent even a lot of time on calls with these CMP vendors, educating them on what they're supposed to be doing. But for us, it's about staying as strict as possible, right?
Have you ever dropped a client, and what did that look like? For not listening to you.
I mean, have we ever let a client go?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a dirty word, really. Like fire and flight. We have once or twice.
Right.
Not necessarily around consent and things like that, but not abiding by how we consider our code of conduct as a company and how we interact with people.
Right.
Luckily, they were both kind of a mutual mistake. Okay, I understand it. This is not working out. Honestly, I never want to be in that situation. We put ourselves in offer and really have a level of support. But in some cases, things just are not working out.
Do you ever get pushback, or do you think most of your clients kind of understand that this is the era of privacy and this is the era of regulation? They have to follow what the rules are.
Never had anyone push back. We've had clients that basically just say, I don't want to be with this, so I'm shutting my website down unless you're in
the
space. That's a crazy
thing. They're
screw it. They're
it's just too
easy. Yeah. And I think that's a little bit of an extreme situation or extreme stance on it. But those publishers are saying, I have zero chance of breaking GDPR. Cannot load my website outside of the United States. There's a ton of US-based laws now, so that becomes a little hairy again. But we've never had a publisher say, I don't like the way that the CMP looks. It's a very simple conversation. You need it. you might have met a law, other than Taylor with you.
Yeah, I want to move into a little bit of programmatic and the current trend of curated supply chains. I actually just spoke with David at TrustX this morning, just briefly, about this also. It seems like everybody's talking about, you know, curated change. I think the word I'm going to use is a curation house, for lack of a better term. Is Attitude jumping on this bandwagon? Are you the conductor leading the orchestra here?
Yeah, so we've certainly tested some of them. I know, like, AppNexus has had a curated marketplace for a very long time. We've tested some of those solutions out in the past. We haven't seen a ton of success there. For us, it's a lot more about, like, how to meet their own marketplaces and aggregate similar types of content, similar types of publishers together. We're not a direct sold house, right? We're really just a tech vendor, but we're, again, in this really unique position where we have so much inventory that advertisers do come to us directly, right? And ask to work with us. And so we will package up, publishers together based on audience types, content categories, even location, right? And try to sell against that. I think for right now, that's kind of the extent of what we're taking us on. It's not really involved in that part of the business. That said, we're all looking to make a lot of investments in this area. We may try to bring a lot of this in-house. Hopefully there's some news about that thing.
Why do you think there's this move towards private marketplaces and curated chain supply?
Concerns that when cookies go away, advertisers will not have any idea what's going on a website. And if they can basically lock in saying, I know ESPN.com is all sports fanatics. I want that. Right? That makes it very clear of what they're getting. But said, like, theoretically, that still can be targeted on your exchange here without cookies. So
right.
Seems like maybe they're kind of advertisers would be just wasting money there. But
are we moving forward or back? It feels like we're moving 20 years back in some ways.
For sure. I feel like we're really far back in time, which is why I said at the beginning of the call, Google knows what's going to happen here. And if they've really made up their minds here, I kindly doubt that we're going to see all of a sudden that all of this spend comes through POPs and preferred deals and these primary marketplaces. It's a very small percentage of our industry right now, unless you're like top five publishers on the planet. I highly doubt that's going to radically change in the next 6 months.
Everyone's talking about AI. How are you using AI without blowing your company up?
Good question. We leverage AI to speed up our work. Right? We're not using AI to replace people. Our employees are leveraging AI to make their jobs easier. So we just did a webinar a few weeks ago on this, but we have a few developers that use different features inside of GitHub, like Copilot, right, to allow them to basically code thousands of lines of code in a matter of minutes. You still have to be smart enough. Any feature form of AI to like actually know if what's being output is the correct answer.
Right.
Is to be able to tweak it if need be, but it allows us to move crazy fast. I mentioned 3,000-4,000 commits a week. Only way we can do that is if we're leveraging some of these technologies to have some ideas around how to integrate ChatGPT into our analytics platform and things like that. But we don't see it as a solution to replace employees. We see it as a way to enhance features that we already had and move faster.
Yeah, how do you stay innovative?
So we have a really flat structure in our company. I say this all the time to our employees. I even said this to Brandon today. Everyone in our company is an adult, right? Everyone
has
right? Everyone has to make any decision they want. As long as they're not breaking the law, I want them to be able to test whatever they want to test. And I want them to come back to us, the executive team, say, look at this idea I came up with. It made this much money. Let's offer it to publishers and this is a new product. We're about to roll this out across our wrapper because we're going to provide a 2% lift for everybody. And so it's a lot less of, you know, Jared demanding that everyone just follow exactly what I say every day. Obviously, I have goals to find. But, you know, from a junior developer with 6 months of experience to someone with 12 years of experience, they have equal right to test things out, the attitude, and we be about it and speak out literally every single day. We have a 15 to 30 minute meeting that we call the growth meeting, where we just talk about whatever crazy idea we can come up.
What compass do you use to navigate the waters of ad tech?
That's the name of it. Great question. So honestly, it's we're trying to stay true to who we are.
Right.
They got built out a really good reputation in the space as someone's like really honest and really upfront about his opinions. And mm-hmm. try to promote that within Attitude as well. Like, culture is a really big part of it. Also, just being on the right side of every story, right? The right side of every change in the space. If there's anything that we ever consider, like, hey, this is going to make our publishers a lot of money, but we don't want to ever be caught up in any blowback from this, we're not going to do it, right? We're trying to stick to the rules 100% of the time. We're not willing to take any risks just to make a buck. And trying to slow down with all of our employees as well, right? Yeah, you have ultimate authority, whatever you want, but you got to play within the rule.
Keep the flames of innovation alive.
If you're rewards.
With what?
So again, we're rewards.
Rewards.
So we're, again, like we're
rewards. You tell Brandon all the time that you really appreciate him and you give him a cookie?
Yeah, promotions.
Brandon's the producer who everyone else can't see, but he can hear us.
So honestly, again, like we're really flat structured. So again, everyone has the right to test things.
Right.
And we reward people very quickly. We've had engineers who come in with no experience where we teach them, and within six months, they've done so much for us that they've had 3 releases. Right. If people who come in and after 6 months, they're put in charge of an entire product. And now they're talking to publishers, they're helping us price it, helping us on marketing, helping put it out, right? And also we do a lot of promotions from within, right? My very first hire in the company, Corey, had almost no background in ad ops whatsoever. Now he's our director of ad operations, right? And now he's more changes than anyone else in the company. It's all around positive feedback, constant communication, and we are, I think, very fairly reward everyone. You know, I learned from what I liked at previous jobs, and what I really did not like at previous jobs, and I try to do the exact opposite.
What's been an unexpected twist in your life or career lately? Something that took you completely by surprise.
How about starting Attitude? Did not mean to build a company. Right? When I went out on my own, I quit my job, couldn't stand to be 5.5 hours a day, 5 days a week. And for me, it was just like, I'm going to consult, I'm going to make some money, and I'm going to have a simpler life, calmer life. I work from home, play golf, spend time with my wife. 6 months later, suddenly, like, I've got an employee, we have 30 clients, we're scaling up, we're building our first wrapper, we're kind of going nuts here. It was a big mental, big mental change for me, right? Like, to switch gears and say, hey, I'm no longer a consultant, like, I'm actually trying to build a company here. And of course, like, when I raise capital in a business again, I never really intended to start, like, oh my God, like, this is. Our life is changing here, right? Like, we are no longer Jared, team people, working from home, having some fun. We are a business trying to make money, trying to grow, and trying to dominate.
Do you think that's because you from the start were solving a problem?
Yeah. We, like, our first product was built because we got a lot of complaints. I got a lot of complaints from existing clients that I was consulting for, right? Like, everyone was kind of saying the same thing. Like, I don't like this. I wish you'd build this, right? And after a few months of hearing, everyone said the exact same thing. Cool, I'm going to build that, right? And as soon as that was done, okay, what's the next thing that's bothering you guys, right? What are you guys all struggling with? What do you not want to put your own money and resources into that you wish someone would offer you? Great, I'm going to build that. And that's where all of our products come from, right? See, hey, all of our clients are spending a ton of money on this other service, and it's not even that great, and it doesn't do what they wanted to do, just build a house, right? And so at this point, it's been really helpful to have such great communication with our publishers. Like, they've helped us build a lot of our business, but also, I think a lot of it is my nature, a lot of our employees' nature. We're all very competitive, we're all very high energy. We like to win, so we're going to do whatever it takes to, you know, to be good.
What really consumes your thoughts late at night? What keeps you up?
A handful of things. Again, I'm now the CEO of a pretty large company.
Right.
You think about...
Is this your first CEO first position?
First time as an entrepreneur. I've obviously been a manager before, but very different responsibilities. Yeah, financial responsibilities.
You're aware that if you screw up, all these people aren't going to have a job.
Correct. So I say this to my wife all the time. It was like, I'm no longer supporting us. I'm supporting all of our employees and their families. And I'm supporting all of our clients and their families. And so I see that super seriously. I don't really sleep that much in general as my whole life. the AM of the night, they do like, how do I make this person another dollar? How do I make them another $10 for their attendee? How do I help this employee do better at their job? You know, as we continue to grow and hire more employees and build out more products, build out new teams, maybe make acquisitions, like, this is only going to get bigger there. For me, the main focus of 2024 is how do I step away from being so involved in every day-to-day activity and start leading the company, right? And
do you think you're micromanaging or no?
I wouldn't say I'm micromanaging, but for 5 years, our team has gotten used to me being involved in every decision. Our team has gotten used to me joining every meeting. Our clients also have gotten used to me joining most meetings and helping them make decisions. And while I don't want to do that, to some extent, it's not really feasible anymore. So we keep hiring more and more senior people who can take on those responsibilities, but also encouraging even our junior employees, like, yeah, you have the right authority to make these kinds of decisions. But it's a major focus for me, right? As a leader of a growing company.
Yeah, every CEO seems to have a drink that hits the spot. What's yours?
It depends on the time of the day. In the morning, I'm a big coffee guy. I love a good iced Americano. Got three different coffee machines in my kitchen, depending on what.
Oh, I do. It's espresso machine, the pod machine, yeah. The cold.
It's a kind of a bad.
It's my only.
But, yeah, so. It's a really bad habit. But without it, I wouldn't be able to operate. I feel like and produce at the level that I know you know.
This is coffee and tea mixed together. Put a little.
I haven't tried that one before. At night, big fan of trying to relax at night. So we have a nice collection of white wines. Quite some Italy, so her family likes to drink wine. Basically, that helps me calm down from the three or four espressos that I've had.
Is there a dish that you ask your wife to cook?
It's the other way around. I'm the one that does most of the cooking. I find cooking, by the way, the best way to calm down. I love cooking.
Oh, I do too. I when I lived in Vegas, I was so lucky that I met all the famous chefs,
oh, nice.
And, like classes and stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
Now pretend I know what I'm.
Yeah, fair enough. I've had some cooking classes with my wife in the past. The most popular request especially right now, it's colder in New York because it's actually
month. Right.
Lots of balsa. My grandma and my late grandma.
And just not when you just all the time.
It's so good. It is so good.
Like from scratch?
Yeah. Do the whole thing. It takes me, usually it's like a Saturday morning, typical morning, Saturday night. We're going to eat it, freeze it, use it again for another 10 meals. Except when I've never had it before growing up until she met me, but now it's one of her favorites.
Imagine, fast forward 10 years, what does the Adscape look like then?
For attitude or just in general?
In general. And attitude.
For attitude. Hopefully world dot basic right now.
Right.
Kind of say this all the time. Like, I've been in this 5 years. Another 10 years would be 15 years of doing this. If I'm still doing the exact same thing that we're doing right now, I think we've kind of failed, right? At that point, hopefully innovated enough where we've either sold a business, acquired enough other businesses where we can kind of be self-sufficient, or we've moved on to something else. The ad marketplace is not going away. I think when I talk to my friends who are not in this space at all, it always blows their mind. Like, how much money is actually made on these websites and how small of a community it is. Things are going to change in terms of what is important to us. Is it no longer maybe display ads or traditional ads are just irrelevant at that point? We have CTV starting to heat up and things like that. Is video really going to become as important as display is today? Maybe the concept of pre-vid is kind of irrelevant as well. Those gold servers are
right
into everything. But I don't think that the ecosystem is going away. What I do think is there's going to be some consolidation. There's way too many small companies that really don't serve a purpose in our industry or in our space, other than
I've made the same comment twice in the last week. Is that, and I meant it's a little bit to you, is that your company, ad tech company, there's so many ad tech companies that serve no purpose.
Yeah,
they don't solve a problem,
right?
Because I don't really need an ad tech company that shocks my cat every single time that. An ad is, right. It feels like that's what I'm being pitched. I'm being pitched these ridiculous solutions that don't solve a problem. Like, oh, that's really cool, but who really needs that? And essentially what we need ad tech to work for us, to serve ads, and then to track results. And that's the main three things.
Yeah. For us, we want to be as full service to publishers as possible. There's plenty of companies out there, like, just making this up. Like, there's companies out there where their only job is to refresh ads.
Right.
15 minutes of development work. how is that a business, right? Things like that. There's so many companies who are just pure ad networks, right?
Right.
They're literally just connecting SSPs to other SSPs and just arbitraging the bank, right? Those kind of concepts and those types of companies, they're not long-lasting businesses, right? If you're not solving a need, then people aren't going to use you. Eventually, they're going to cut you out and just go direct, right? Or build it out themselves. And so I do think there's going to be a lot of consolidation. There's a lot of SSPs out there that are really not SSPs at all. Don't offer anything unique or their own thought or any other gobbled up or
right.
How to go out of business in the ad tech.
There's a lot of white labeled products too, I noticed, that you can just claim you're a new SSP and it's really just the same one.
Not only is it the same one, we've seen some of those come to us where it's the same ID. They don't even bother changing anything on the back.
You look at the bid stream and it's all, you're like, I know what this is.
Yeah, exactly what you're white labeling now, exactly what account it is and things like that, right? So I don't think those types of companies are going to last. They're great at making money really quickly, but at some point people are going to catch on and be like, I need this, I can just do this myself, right? Or go direct to those SSPs. So I think it's going to be much more the same, but just probably fewer players.
Before we go, I already asked you this once. If you could send yourself a time traveling text message when you started in the industry, what would it be?
Yeah. So last time I said I would have started my business 5 years sooner. This time I'll say to hire sooner and spend faster. It took me 3 years, really, for me to hire a second employee. And it was because I was so nervous that thing I was spoke about earlier, I'm so nervous to have the responsibility of someone else's life and family on my shoulders. And God forbid it didn't work out. Oh my God, I just ruined someone's life, right? And so it was a really big decision for me to hire our first engineer, our CTO Eric. I did it. 3 months later, I was like, this is the best decision I ever made. Oh my God. He's taking on so much of the responsibility from a development perspective off of my shoulders. And I'm cool on her head with, if I can't solve something, I've got no one else to solve it, right? I should have done it 2 years earlier because we'd probably be late for a long time in our career or business.
Thank you to Jared Siegel for sitting down with us. And as always, special thanks to Troutman Amin, because you deserve to win when it matters most. Next week, we have Fred Godfrey of Origin and Mike Seaman of Digital Remedy. See you next week.